The candle still burned in the tent, and it must be past midnight by now. The flame drew her as though she were a moth. She rose and crossed to the tent, silently, almost furtively. She lifted the flap and slipped in, letting it drop closed behind her. Ralph lay on his back on the steel cot, his booted feet dangling to the ground, and one arm covered his face. He was making an unhappy little whimpering sound in his sleep. The candle was guttering, burned down into a puddle of its own molten wax, and the smell of spilled whiskey was sharp and pungent. Elizabeth crossed to the tea-chest and set the fallen bottle upright. Then the open page of the journal caught her attention, and she read the big, uneven scrawl. "War makes monsters of us all." It gave her a pang of pity so sharp that she closed the leather-bound journal quickly and looked at the man who had written that agonized heart cry. She wanted to reach across and touch his unshaven cheek, but instead she hitched her nightdress in a businesslike fashion and squatted beside the cot. She undid the straps of his riding boots, and then, taking them one at a time between her knees, she pulled them off his feet. Ralph muttered and flung the arm off his face, rolling away from the candlelight. Gently, Elizabeth lifted his legs and swung them up onto the cot. He groaned and curled into a fetal position. "Big baby," she whispered, and smiled to herself. Then she could resist no longer, and she stroked the thick, dark lock of hair off his forehead. His skin was fever-hot, moist with sweat, and she laid her palm against his cheek. His dark new beard was stiff and harsh. The feel of it sent electric prickles shooting up her arm. She pulled her hand away, and once more businesslike, unfolded the blanket from the foot of the cot and drew it over his body. She leaned over him to settle it under his chin, but he rolled over again, and before she could jump back, one hard, muscular arm wrapped over her shoulder. She lost her balance and fell against his chest, and the arm pinned her helplessly. She lay very still, her heart pounding wildly. After a minute, the grip of his arm relaxed, and gently she tried to free herself. At her first movement, the arm locked about her with such savage strength that her breath was driven from her lungs with a gasp. Ralph mumbled and brought his other hand over, and she convulsed with shock as it settled high up on the back of her thigh. She dared not move. She knew she could not break the grip of his restraining arm. She had never expected him to be so powerful. She felt as helpless as an unweaned infant, totally in his power. She felt the heat of his body soaking through her nightdress, felt the hand behind her begin to fumble and grope upwards. And then she sensed the moment when he became conscious. The hand slid up to the nape of her neck, and her head was pulled forward with a gentle but irresistible force until she felt the heat and the wetness of his mouth spread over hers. He tasted of whiskey and something else, a yeasty, musky man taste, and without her volition, her own lips melted and spread to meet his. Her senses spun like wheels of flame behind her closed eyelids. The sensations were so tumultuous that for long moments she did not realize that he had swept her nightdress up to the level of her shoulder blades, and now his fingers, hard as bone and hot as fire, ran in a long, slow caress down the cleft of her naked buttocks and then settled into the soft curve where they joined her thighs. It galvanized her. Her breath sobbed in her throat, and she struggled to be free, to escape from the torture of her own wild wanting, of her cruel need for him, and from his skillful, insistent fingers. He held her easily, his mouth against the soft of her throat, and his voice was hoarse and rough. "Kathy," he said. "My Katie, I missed you so." Elizabeth stopped struggling. She lay against him like a dead woman, no longer fighting, no longer even breathing. "Katie!" His hands were desperate to find her, but she was dead, dead. He was fully awake now. His hands left Elizabeth's body and came up to her face. He cupped her head in his hands and lifted it. He looked at her uncomprehendingly for a long moment, and then she saw the green change in his eyes. Not Kathy, he whispered. She opened his fingers gently and stood up beside the cot. Not Kathy, she said softly. Kathy has gone, Ralph. She stooped over the guttering candle, cupped one hand behind it, and blew it out. Then she stood upright again in the sudden total darkness. She unfastened the bodice of her nightdress, shrugged it over her shoulders, and let it fall around her ankles. She stepped out of it and lay down on the cot beside Ralph. She took his unresisting hand and replaced it where it had been before. Not Kathy, she whispered. Tonight it's Elizabeth. Tonight and forevermore. And she placed her mouth over his. And when at last she felt him fill all the sad and lonely places within her, her joy was so intense that it seemed to crush and bruise her soul, and she said, I love you. I have always loved you. I will always love you. Jordan Ballantyne stood beside his father on the platform of the Cape Town railway station. They were both stiff and awkward in the moment of parting. Please don't forget to give my... Jordan hesitated over the choice of words. My very warmest regards to Louise. I am sure she will be pleased, said Zuga. I have not seen her for so long. Zuga broke off. The separation from his wife had drawn over the long months of his trial in the Queen's Bench Division of the High Court before the Lord Chief Justice Baron Pollock, Mr. Justice Hawkins, and a special jury. The Lord Chief Justice had shepherded a reluctant jury towards the inevitable verdict. I direct you that, in accordance with the evidence and your answers to the specific questions I have put to you, that you ought to find a verdict of guilty against all the defendants. And he had had his way. The sentence of the court, therefore, is that, as to you, Leander Starr Jamieson, and as to you, John Willoughby, that you be confined for a period of 15 months' imprisonment without hard labour. That you, Major Zuga Ballantyne, have 3 months' imprisonment without hard labour. Zuga had served 4 weeks of his sentence in Holloway, and with the balance remitted, had been released to the dreadful news that in Rhodesia the Matabele had risen and that Bulawayo was under siege. The voyage southwards down the Atlantic had been agonising. He had had no word of Louise or of King's Lynn, and his imagination conjured up horrors that were nourished by tales of slaughter and mutilation. Only when the Union Castle mailboat had docked that morning in Cape Town Harbour were his terrible anxieties relieved. She is safe in Bulawayo, Jordan had answered his first question. Overcome with emotion, Zuga had embraced his youngest son, repeating, Oh, thank God, over and over again. They had lunched together in the dining room of the Mount Nelson Hotel, and Jordan had given his father the latest intelligence from the north. Napier and the Siege Committee seemed to have stabilised the situation. They've got the survivors into Bulawayo, and Grey and Soluce and Ralph, with their irregulars, have given the rebels a few bloody knocks to keep them at a wary distance. Of course, the Matabele have an absolutely free run of the territory outside the lagers at Bulawayo and Quello and Bilingue. They do as they please, though strangely enough, they do not seem to have closed the road to the southern drifts. If you can reach Kimberley in time to join the relief column that Spreckley is taking through, you should be in Bulawayo by the end of the month, and Mr. Rhodes and I will not be long in joining you. Spreckley will be taking through only essential supplies and a few hundred men to stiffen the defence of Bulawayo until the Imperial troops can get there. As you probably know, Major General Sir Frederick Carrington has been chosen to command, and Mr. Rhodes and I will be going up with his staff. I have no doubt we will bring the rebels to book very swiftly. Jordan kept up a monologue during the entire meal to cover the embarrassment caused by the stares and the whispers of the other diners, who were deliciously scandalised by the presence of one of Jamieson's freebooters in their midst. Zuga ignored the stir he was creating and addressed himself to the meal and the conversation with Jordan until a young journalist from the Cape Times, clutching his shorthand pad, approached the table. I wonder if you'd care to comment on the leniency of the sentences passed by the Lord Chief Justice. Only then did Zuga raise his head, and his expression was bleak. In the years ahead, they will give medals and knighthoods to men who achieve exactly the same task that we attempted, he said quietly. Now, will you be kind enough to let us finish our lunch in peace? At the railway station, Jordan fussed over making certain that Zuga's trunk was in the goods van and that he had a forward-facing seat in the last carriage. Then they faced each other awkwardly as the guard blew his warning whistle. Mr. Rhodes asked me to inquire whether you would still be good enough to act as his agent at Bulawayo. Tell Mr. Rhodes that I am honoured by his continued confidence. They shook hands, and Zuga climbed into the coach. If you see Ralph... Yes? Zuga asked. Oh, never mind. Jordan shook his head. I hope you have a safe journey, Papa. Leaning from the carriage window as the train pulled out from the platform, Zuga studied the receding figure of his youngest son. He was a fine-looking young fellow, Zuga decided, tall and athletic, his grey three-piece suit in fashion, yet also in perfect understated taste. And yet there was something incongruous about him, an air of the lost waif, an aura of uncertainty and deep-rooted unhappiness. Damned nonsense, Zuga told himself, and drew his head in and pulled up the window by its leather strap. The locomotive built up speed across the Cape Flats for its assault on the rampart of mountains that guarded the African continental shield. Jordan Ballantyne cantered up the driveway towards the great white house that crouched amongst its oaks and stone pines on the lower slopes of the flat-topped mountain. He was pursued by a feeling of guilt. It was many years since he had neglected his duties for an entire day. Even a year ago it would have been unthinkable for him to do so. Every day, Sunday and public holidays notwithstanding, Mr. Rhodes needed him close at hand. The subtle change in their relationship was something that increased his feelings of guilt and introduced a darker, more corrosive emotion. It had not been entirely necessary for him to spend the whole day with his father. From when the mail ship worked her way into Table Bay with the furious red dawn and the southeaster raging about her, until the Northern Express pulled out from under the glass dome of Cape Town Station. He could have slipped away and been back at his desk within a few hours. But he had tried to force a refusal out of Mr. Rhodes, an acknowledgement of his own indispensability. "Take a few days if you like, Jordan. Arnold will be able to handle anything that might come up." Mr. Rhodes had barely glanced up from the London papers. "There is that new draft of Clause 27 of your will," Jordan had tried to provoke him, and instead received the reply he most dreaded. "Oh, give that to Arnold. It's time he understood about the scholarships. Anyway, it'll give him a chance to use that new-fangled Remington machine of his." Mr. Rhodes's childlike pleasure in having his correspondence printed out swiftly and neatly on the calligraph was another source of disquiet to Jordan. Jordan had not yet mastered the calligraph's noisy keyboard, chiefly because Arnold's jealousy monopolized the machine. Jordan had ordered his own model shipped out to him, but it had to come from New York, and it would be months yet before he could expect it to arrive. Now he reined in the big glossy bay at the steps to Groote Schuur's back stoop, and as he dismounted he tossed the reins to the groom and hurried into the house. He took the back stairs to the second floor and went directly to his own room, unbuttoning his shirt and pulling the tails from his breeches as he kicked the door closed behind him. He poured water from the Delft jug into the basin and splashed it onto his face. Then he dried on a fluffy white towel, tossed it aside, and picked up the silver-handled brushes and ran them over his crisp golden curls. He was about to turn away from the mirror and find a fresh shirt when he stopped and stared thoughtfully at his own image. Slowly he leaned closer to the glass and touched his face with his fingertips. There were crow's feet at the outer corners of his eyes. He stretched the skin between his fingers, but the lines persisted. He turned his head slightly. The light from the tall window showed up the pouches beneath his eyes. "You only see them at that angle," he thought, and then flattened his hair back from the peak of his forehead with the palm of his hand. There was the pearly gleam of his scalp through the thinning strands, and quickly he fluffed his hair up again.